Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, with the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics in Leadership, dedicated to offering virtual lectures with speakers who inspire. More at viterbo.edu/ethics.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Milwaukee was once home to a handful of natatoria, or public bathhouses, that attracted over 500,000 visitors each year. We'll learn about the history of those buildings and what's become of them today. First, we check in on the top stories of the week from Washington. This week, White House advisor Jared Kushner had his security clearance downgraded. Plus, a top intelligence official says the president hasn't ordered action against Russian election hacking. And a Supreme Court ruling says some immigrants can be held indefinitely without bond, even if they have a legal status in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your take on Jared Kushner's role in the White House after losing his top-level security clearance? Can he continue to function in his role there? And are you worried about Russia's intrusion into U.S. politics in upcoming elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian, based in Washington. Sabrina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you reported on this. President Trump's advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had been working on an interim high-level security clearance that was downgraded. We found out why.
Well, this is the fallout from the Rob Porter scandal. You'll recall Rob Porter was a staff secretary to President Trump, who was accused by both of his ex-wives of domestic violence. And it was revealed that Porter, as well as many aides within the White House, were operating off of interim security clearances and were still undergoing a background check by the FBI. Kushner is one of those people and has had some access to some of the most sensitive and classified information, even though he has yet to receive permanent security clearance. And it appears that there are many red flags, or at least some red flags, in his background checks.
Can you talk about some of those red flags, the things that have delayed him getting the permanent security clearance?
Well, there are very complex financial arrangements that he has through his business as a real estate developer overseas. He also has had other financial difficulties, such as acquiring a great amount of debt. And that is the subject of another revelation that was made in the Washington Post, that as many as four countries had discussed Kushner as a target for political manipulation, due not just to some of those issues within his own background, but also his lack of political experience. And so I suspect that as the federal government was conducting this background check, some of these pieces were picked up in the secure channels of the way that other countries have discussed Kushner and his role, as well as, of course, just someone who came from a longstanding career in New York with a great deal of financial investments, including those overseas. And, of course, that makes it very difficult to operate in the role that he's been given, particularly if you take into account his own foreign policy portfolio.
Yeah, talk about his job at the White House. He's been doing a lot, right?
The joke is there's nothing Jared can't do because he has been tasked with negotiating peace in the Middle East. He has also been overseeing U.S. relations with China. At one point, he was charged with leading this Office of American Innovation that was going to reform the federal bureaucracy. So there's a lot that's been put on his plate. But I think that one of the other issues that, of course, have come up is his role in the investigation into Russian interference in the U.S. election, given some of the meetings that he took during the campaign of the transition with Russian officials. So there are a lot of different pieces of this very complex web that I think have culminated really in a pivotal moment for Kushner and his future in the White House.
And that's the big question. Without this top-level security clearance, with possible changes there, can he continue to do all that stuff that you just listed?
Well, the White House is arguing that Kushner can continue in his role. There is something to be said for the president's authority here. This is his son-in-law, so there's an issue of loyalty. But also, in general, the president can choose to grant anyone permanent security clearance. He can share classified information with whomever he so chooses. So we don't know if he's going to continue to share classified information with Kushner. But outside national security experts have told me, and they've certainly been out in public saying they don't see how Kushner can go into these meetings with foreign leaders not having potentially seen some of the classified information that you would need to have been apprised of in order to be taken seriously. And then with this report in the Washington Post that he has been viewed as somewhat of a vulnerability, that he is seen as someone who can be taken advantage of and seen as naive by foreign officials, there's a credibility problem, too, that I think will really come down to what President Trump wants to do. Does he want to continue to prioritize having his family members in these high-ranking positions, or is he going to side with John Kelly, the chief of staff, who I think has had an eye out for Kushner, and choose instead more traditional governance, rather than having to deal with the headache of what will probably be a growing chorus of people in Washington calling for Kushner to go.
We're talking to Sabrina Siddiqui from The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, as we do every week at this time. Moving on to another issue now, Sabrina, the director of the National Security Agency, Mike Rogers, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that he had not addressed Russian cyber attacks at the source because the president hadn't directed him to do so yet. Here's Rogers being questioned by Democratic Senator Jack Reed.
Have you been directed to do so, given the strategic threat that faces the United States and the significant consequences you recognize already?
No, I have not, but if I could flesh this out, I'll say something in an open, unclassified. I'd be glad to go into more details.
Yes, sir.
In a classified. Based on the authority that I have as a commander, I have directed the National Mission Force to begin some specific work. I'd rather not publicly go into that, right, using the authorities that I retain as a commander in this mission space.
So as inherent ability of a commander to prepare, plan,
yes, sir,
and structure, but you need the direct authority of the president through the Secretary of Defense
to do some specific things.
So what are we hearing in that wider conversation, Sabrina?
So I think that this is notable because a lot of the conversation has centered around the special counsel's investigation into whether or not there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow. And that's certainly a very important piece of this. But the issue at the heart of it is, of course, the fact that Moscow was able to intervene in the democratic process here in the United States. And what is being done to prevent that from happening in the future, especially with midterm elections around the corner? And so to have one of the top national security officials within the Trump administration saying that the president has not responded with the level of severity that is required, that's very significant. Trump could, at any point in time, direct Rogers to disrupt Russian efforts to meddle in elections at the source. And also what he could do is he could implement sanctions that were overwhelmingly passed by Congress last year against Russia that were in response to their meddling in the election. Instead of implementing those mandatory sanctions, Trump moved in January to delay their implementation and has yet to impose them. So I think when you take those two things together, it calls into question Trump's foreign policy toward Russia more broadly, but also more specifically why he is not taking a tough line against Russia at a time when near everyone, not just the U.S., but also its allies, have agreed that they pose such a considerable national security risk.
And Rogers also said something to the effect, I think, of Russia has gotten the message that there's not a big penalty if they continue to do this. Is that right?
Exactly. And this actually follows comments along similar lines from other top national security officials. With Rogers saying that Vladimir Putin has not yet had to pay a price, you have to then think about what tactics they are looking to employ in November as we gear up toward midterms. Dan Coats, who is the director of national intelligence, he had told lawmakers while testifying on Capitol Hill previously, that he expects Russia will again employ a lot of the same fake news and propaganda that they did in 2016. His quote was that they would continue and use those tactics, and now I quote, to try to build on its wide range of operations and exacerbate social and political fissures in the United States. So that's what the implications of inaction appear to be, according to Trump's own national security team. The question, of course, is whether or not there'll be more pressure on the president to heed their calls.
We're talking to Sabrina Siddiqui from The Guardian, looking at the week's top national political news. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, there have been calls for changes to gun laws in the United States after the shooting in Florida a couple weeks back. President meeting this afternoon with a bipartisan group of members of Congress to look at things like background checks. What, if anything, do you think should change when it comes to gun laws? Do you think anything will change in the short term? Do you want to see expanded background checks, closing these so-called loopholes in the system, changes in age limits on various kinds of firearms? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sabrina Siddiqui is with us, political reporter at The Guardian. We're looking at some of the week's top stories in national politics. Right now we move to gun laws, possible changes after the shooting in Florida a couple of weeks ago. President meeting with members of Congress on that. What, if anything, do you think should change? Call 800-642-1234. And Sabrina, we've seen a lot of protests, the students involved who survived that shooting in many ways leading the way. What are we seeing? What's the latest from the president and Congress?
Well, the president just convened this bipartisan meeting at the White House with a group of senators to discuss some alternatives in terms of stricter gun laws. I do think, having said that, we're seeing a very familiar scenario play out where there are a lot of ideas. Some of them are bipartisan, but there is no real consensus on what, you know, the one or two pieces of legislation are that could feasibly pass both the Senate and the House. A lot of eyes are on a bill known as Fix Nix, which was offered by John Cornyn, the second-ranking Republican, and Chris Murphy, who is a Democrat from Connecticut, of course, has been in office since Sandy Hook took place as well. And that focuses on enforcing the existing background check system. It is not universal background checks, which is what they tried to pass after Sandy Hook. And even that bill is running into some hurdles, with conservatives and liberals alike taking issue with it for either not doing enough or doing too much. So I think the question, again, is if you can't even get consensus for some of these more modest bills, then it's hard to imagine that lawmakers are going to take any meaningful action, unless, of course, there is a sustained grassroots movement, which is what we've been seeing from these students.
So we're going to call her now. Connie is with us in New Lisbon. Connie, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
I'm pro-Second Amendment. I think it's our constitutional right to own guns. But that said, I would like to see some changes. Maybe at 18, you can buy long arms, you know, shotguns and rifles, and then no handguns until 21. And either way, in addition to the background check, I think there needs to be a safety training class. You need to have a permit to then go buy one, so everyone is safer.
Connie, thanks for the call. And age limits, changes to age limits for some firearms, Sabrina, is something people are talking about. As I understand it, I think I may be wrong, and I don't have this in front of me. In Florida, it may be already that you have to wait till 21 for a handgun. I'm not sure about that. But is that one of the things people are talking about at the national level?
Well, I think that, you know, there have been different discussions about the proposals that restrict access to firearms. I think that, you know, overall, there's not enough support in either party for an assault weapons ban. A high capacity magazines ban is also one that's been discussed, which of course limits the rounds of ammunition. Some of these mass shootings, you've seen people with 100 rounds of ammunition, and that, of course, it allows them to cause a lot more damage much more quickly. I also don't think, though, there's enough bipartisan support for even that. There's been some talk maybe of raising the age limit from 18 to 21, and that's something that the president had initially suggested he would support. But he's recently seemed to walk back his support for that proposal, which is something that the NRA has come out against and effectively declared a non-starter. So in terms of some of these more substantive pieces of legislation that would actually try and limit who has access to certain types of firearms, I think that those are the most difficult to achieve, which is why a lot of emphasis is once again on background checks. But again, as I said, you know, the proposals that they're looking at more seriously don't instate any new background checks or expand them. They only focus on enforcing the existing law.
Ben in Stevens Point called, couldn't stay on the line. Ben says people are blaming an inanimate object while multiple arms of government failed to prevent this attack. Is that part of the conversation, too, the idea that the FBI failed to follow up on a lead that the perpetrator here might be someone who would cause this kind of incident?
Well, I would say sorry, can you just, I didn't get the last part of that question. If
oh,
you don't mind.
Sure. Have people been talking about systemic failures of law enforcement, as Ben was pointing toward there, as part of the conversation at the national level?
Well, I think that you do have Republicans who are similar to the president, zeroing in on the ways in which law enforcement had missed tips about this particular shooter and a lot of the signs that were pointing this way. I think that there is, having said that, still a sense among lawmakers that it won't be enough to steer the conversation entirely away from firearms, because you have this one shooting where there were a lot of warnings that were ignored by law enforcement, but most of the that hasn't been the case in the vast majority of other mass shootings that have transpired over the last few years. So I think that it might provide somewhat of an out for some lawmakers who don't want to address the issue of guns, but I think that the grassroots movement is certainly signaling that there might be a penalty to pay if they try and overlook that part of the conversation entirely. I will only add one more thing to that piece of the conversation. Some of the fixation on the president's part has been that there was an armed guard who didn't go into the school during the course of the shooting. That person has resigned, and there's an investigation pending. But that actually, if anything, has countered one of the talking points that you've seen from the NRA and some of their supporters, that there should be more armed guards at schools, because in this case, clearly there was one, and that wasn't enough to stop the carnage.
Talking to Sabrina Siddiqui from The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national news. I want to move on. The Department of Justice yesterday announced it would be supporting local lawsuits against opioid manufacturers for their role in the opioid epidemic. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
I am announcing today that the department will file a statement of interest in a lawsuit against a number of opioid manufacturers and distributors for allegedly using false, deceptive, and unfair marketing of opioid drugs. The federal government has borne substantial cost as a result of this crisis. The Medicare prescription drug program, for example, paid out more than $4 billion for opioids in 2016 alone. The hardworking taxpayers of this country deserve to be compensated by any whose illegal activity contributed to these costs.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions there. Sabrina, there are a lot of local and state lawsuits against these pharmaceutical companies, including some local governments in Wisconsin. How important is it that the U.S. Department of Justice is backing this idea now?
Well, it's certainly significant. Do you think that one of the issues that the Trump administration has said is a priority is trying to combat the opioid crisis? And they've taken some heat for not having necessarily followed those promises with any meaningful action. Certainly, I think that when you have the Justice Department intervening now, that sends a very strong signal from the top. But I think that the other piece of this, of course, is that you have a task force that has been commissioned. There was another opioid task force that had been commissioned by the White House, not specifically to deal with the litigation, which is what the Justice Department is doing, but to deal with the crisis more broadly. And they did deliver a report, and then you didn't see the White House act on a lot of their recommendations. So I think the natural question in a lot of people's minds following today's announcement is where the Justice Department will go from here and the extent through which to which it's going to follow through on what is certainly a significant step on their part.
I want to turn to the Supreme Court now. Yesterday, the court issued a ruling saying that some immigrants to the U.S. can be held in custody indefinitely without a bond hearing. So what does this mean, Sabrina?
Well, I think that one of the things that's important about this is that, well, first and foremost, you've seen a number of important decisions before the court when it comes to immigration. The real issue at hand has been whether immigrants who are seeking admission to the U.S. Who are subject to mandatory federal detention must be afforded court status hearings and with the possibility that they could be released into the country. So I think that this is certainly one of those rulings where you have seen some of the you have seen largely this line up with, I think, the Trump administration's view to crack down in some ways on those who are seeking permanent entry to the country. I think you had the conservative justices kind of come out strongly against the idea of undocumented immigrants or those seeking asylum having a vehicle for entry. So that's kind of the key takeaway here from this particular decision.
All right, it's a story we'll watch along with many of the other ones we've talked about today. Sabrina, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And talking to Sabrina Siddiqui, a political reporter for The Guardian based in Washington, D.C. She was with us for our weekly roundup of some of the top stories in national politics. Now, if you want to take a bath, chances are you don't have to leave your house. But if you were living in Milwaukee in the late 1800s, you might have gone to your local natatorium. The city was once home to seven of the buildings, which offered bathing, swimming, and other services. Our next guest profiled the public bathing facilities for On Milwaukee. Do you have a memory of a natatorium in Milwaukee? Was it where you learned to swim? Did you grow up near one of them or were one of the buildings that succeeded it? Let us know your story. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Bobby Tanzillo is a writer and senior editor for On Milwaukee, where he writes a regular feature called Urban Spelunking. Bobby, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
Paint us a picture, Bobby. If we went back in time and went into a natatorium when it was in full swing, what would we have seen?
Originally they were built to have sort of a dual purpose, as you said, of being a place where kids could learn to swim or where they could just swim for recreation. But also they had private shower rooms because most people's houses did not have those kinds of facilities. And there were a few other places in Milwaukee that offered those kinds of services, social centers, neighborhood centers, those kinds of things. But in the old days, I mean, they were packed. And, there are some pictures in the story on the site on Milwaukee that show, like, groups of kids, lining the pool on all four sides and up on the balcony above. And, in the 1920s, there were apparently almost 700,000 people used the natatoriums, which is pretty amazing when you consider that's, slightly more than the population of the city.
And when I think of a city publicly supporting a bath, I guess I go back to ancient Rome. How did this come into existence in Milwaukee in the late 1800s?
Apparently there had been discussions in a lot of cities about this kind of thing, but Milwaukee was one of the first to make it actually happen. And there had been talk going back to basically when the city was first chartered about this, but it didn't really actually happen until the 1880s, and then the first one opened in 1889.
And what was the case people were making to have this?
I think it was just that. It was the fact that people, there was the recreation component, but I think what was really the bigger issue for people was that it was a cleanliness issue, a public health,
hygiene. And yeah, was there a European background to this?
I wouldn't be surprised. I think people probably knew the same things we know you know, about this. You know, ancient Rome, you know, all these Turkish baths, all these other kinds of baths, they were out there. People knew that they existed. I don't know that there's a direct lineage to it. But, you know, when the first one opened, the newspaper called it a temple dedicated to cleanliness. So I think that tells you sort of what the goal was. More so than kids having a good time diving, it was cleanliness, hygiene.
And this was a big hit, it sounds like. The first one, there ended up being 7 total, right? You talk about how this was built and then they started to spread?
Yeah, they built the first one just sort of on the far west side of downtown on 7th and Highland, where MATC is now. And then that one was so popular that they added a second one, and then which was the one on the south side. That people still tend to think of, even though the building is now gone. The building survived for a while after the natatorium closed, but people tend to remember that one because it was famous as a restaurant that had dolphins swimming in the tank. And then, you know, they just sort of started to pop up, and, you know, then there were a couple added on the north side, a couple more added on the south side over time. And the last one that was built in 1917.
And then these were mainly for the water, the pools, and the baths, but they started, some of them had other stuff, a public library in one of them, other facilities?
Yeah, the one on 16th and North Avenue actually had a public library in it, which was unusual. The others did not.
Now, describe the buildings to us. You noted a recurring theme, I think, in the style.
Yeah, well, the first one was designed by this guy named Herman Schnetzky, who did a lot of schoolhouses and things like that in Milwaukee, and tended to work in a sort of Romanesque revival style. So that first one looked like that, had the big arches, like what we think of as Romanesque design. But after that, they all sort of became neoclassical with these columns, you know, the sort of sturdy looking buildings with these sort of, you know, Palladian columns out front. And they all sort of followed that same theme. And inside, they followed the same sort of thing, too. You walked in, and they all had the big tank, as they called it, which was the pool right in the center. And then there was a balcony above it that had changing rooms and the showers and all that. And if you look at the interiors of them, they all really follow that. One or two had an extra floor above, but still the same layout, basically.
Talking to Bobby Tanzillo from On Milwaukee, looking at the historical Natatoria of Milwaukee, these bathing and swimming facilities, their rise and fall, which we'll get to in just a bit. I want to bring on a caller. Nick is with us in Lancaster. Nick, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
Do you have a memory?
You know, I grew up on the south side of Milwaukee, and I remember my dad taking us to the auditorium on 10th and Hayes. And I can't remember if it was free or like a nickel, but it was just an awesome place to go. And I'm in my 60s now, and the memory's really there. It was an awesome place.
And you went there for swimming, Nick?
Well, we went there for swimming and, you know, just to hang out and spend time together as a family. You know, I have one brother, and you know, my dad and my brother and I would go. I don't remember if I learned how to swim there or if I just got thrown off a pier somewhere. But
another popular way.
Right, yeah, Wisconsin way. Nick, thanks a lot for sharing that story. And, yeah, this was a family activity, it sounds like, Bobby, and a social activity for a lot of people.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, from the comments I got after when the story initially ran, tons of people said that they still had the swimming card that they earned when they passed the class, or they had medals that they won at swim meets there. Loads of people said they went with their entire families. What I heard even more was lots of kids went with in a big group from the neighborhood. You know, like 10 kids on a block would just get their stuff and walk over to the NAD, as they called it.
And it sounds like the main purpose changed over time as more people got bathtubs and showers at home. The hygiene was less of the highlight, and the swimming was more of the big deal.
Yes, that definitely did change, you know, by the, you know, after you get through sort of the first third of the 20th century, the focus turns to the swimming more than the hygiene part.
And why did they start to decline even as swimming facilities?
Well, you know, part of it was that the county started to build pools in the parks, which drew some people away. But also, even in the 40s, there were reports that the city was doing that found that, I've had people tell me since that they had memories of this, too, that the people who worked in some of the natatoriums were really not very nice, frankly. And so you had a lot of these natatorium workers who were mean to the kids, who were sort of short with people, were sort of haughty And it turned off a lot of people who I think started to find alternate ways to amuse themselves. And then, you know, it really declines in the 40s, which and then into the 50s, which coincides with television, of course, and again, those public pools that start to be built outside as well.
And Bobby, you'd mentioned one of them was converted into a famous restaurant that had dolphins, and I think our next caller is going to take us there. TR is with us in Madison. TR, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I'm a professional juggler, and in the 80s, I did a show with my brother. We did a lot of things in Milwaukee, and someone told us about the restaurant and auditorium. So we went there and introduced ourselves and told them not only were we professional jugglers, but that we had been in Hawaii and we had swum with the dolphins a number of times. And so they asked us if we would do a juggling show for the dolphins. So first we did that. They had a little platform where the trainer would stand on the edge of the pool. And the dolphins were completely unimpressed with human juggling. They spent a lot, most of the day, they watched for about 10 or 15 seconds, and then they proceeded to squirt us with mouthfuls of water. and then we asked the trainer, would it be all right, could we go swimming with the dolphins sometime? And they looked at us with great big eyes and said, you do that? And we said, sure, we've done that lots of times. And which we have swum with wild dolphins in Hawaii, which are spinner dolphins, and they're like maybe 5.5 feet long. These were the ones in the pool were Atlantic bottlenose, which were 12 and 15 feet long.
Oh, wow.
Big, big dolphins.
And how did that go?
They said, well, they had one mask. So my partner had the mask, and we both got in the water with them and swam around. The female was really, really friendly. She would swim right up to you, rub her body against you, allow you to put her arm over you and drag you around the pool. But the more she did that, the more aggressive the male got. And after about 15 minutes, my partner let me have the mask, and I put it on. And as soon as I had the mask on, the male swam right up in my face and opened his mouth and showed me the 66 big pearly white teeth he had.
TR, I'm going to jump in. That's a close encounter there. That was one of the most famous things, that restaurant, Bobby, that used the Natatorium building. What's there now for some of the surviving buildings that used to house the Natatorium?
Well, you know, there are not many that survive. There is one that survives, and it is currently home to a private school. It had been a community center for many years, and then now it's a private school.
And the rest of them have all been demolished, is that right?
Yep, the rest have all been demolished over time.
And you mentioned the response you got. I was starting to look at the comments on Milwaukee and our first caller today. A lot of people have memories of swimming, not always with dolphins, but
right.
of swimming.
Rarely
in the
Rarely with dolphins, yes.
And then as you were pitching this idea and talking about it, Bobby, did you get any sense that people would want this sort of thing today? Or is this something that's strictly, you know, last century sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, I can't tell. I mean, basically everybody who commented just talked about how much they loved it when they were a kid, you know. There was nobody really said, let's, you know, we should have these again. Although I think there would be, you know, in a city like Milwaukee where you have a lot of kids, and especially in the summer, a lot of kids who don't have enough to do probably that's constructive, you know, it seems like a great idea to have these kinds of places where kids could get together and swim and play games and do things like, you know, not necessarily with pools, but I definitely think Milwaukee needs more places for kids, not fewer.
Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bobby Tanzillo is a writer and senior editor for On Milwaukee. He was with us for a look back at the rise and fall of Milwaukee's public bathing and swimming facilities. During last week's primary election in Wisconsin, voters narrowed down the race for a seat on the state Supreme Court. Wisconsin judicial races are technically nonpartisan, meaning that candidates aren't listed as belonging to one party or another. But voters paying attention likely knew the political leanings of the candidates. One even said he was a Democrat. Our next guest wrote an article for our partner WisContext and took a look at the role politics is playing in these supposedly nonpartisan races. Aaron Weinschenk is an associate professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, as we approach this primary race last week, there was a lot of overt talk about politics from a couple of the candidates. What kind of things were we hearing leading up to the race?
Yeah, I think as you mentioned, some of them were explicitly saying what their partisan affiliation was. Some of them ran ads featuring partisan figures like President Trump. So, you know, it was pretty easy if you were paying attention to the race to pick up on what people's partisan leanings were or what their ideology might be.
And even when the justices or the justice candidates aren't specifically saying these things, very often they're getting donations from a political party or speaking at party conventions. These nonpartisan races have a lot of partisan overtones, right?
Yeah, exactly. It seems like they're nonpartisan in name only, and that, you know, it doesn't take much work to glean, you know, what the affiliations are of different candidates in a lot of these races.
And that's where some research you did comes in. The question is, do voters treat these as partisan races? How did you try to sort out whether the voters of Wisconsin had a partisan approach when they voted for a Supreme Court candidate?
Yeah, so I was interested, specifically interested in the connection between presidential politics and these races, these, again, nonpartisan races. So I gathered data on presidential election outcomes in Wisconsin counties and then the election returns in a bunch of the judicial races just to see if there was any relationship. So, you know, I think most people would say that how a county voted in a presidential race is a pretty good measure of partisanship. So is there any connection between those two? And it turns out that there is a very strong connection, at least in a lot of the elections that have happened in Wisconsin in the past 10 years or so.
Yeah, break down some of your data for us. Take us on a little tour.
Yeah, so I started by the thing that motivated me was, like, let's look at this in the primary that just happened. So I gathered data on how Trump did in each of the Wisconsin 72 counties and then how the conservative candidate did, and really, really strong correlation between the two. So if you know how the county voted in the presidential race, you can do a pretty good job predicting of how they're going to vote in the Supreme Court race. And then I was like, I'm curious, does this happen in other races? So I went back all the way to 2003, did the same thing, and found really strong relationships between the presidential vote in the county and vote for the Supreme Court candidate.
So what's happening there? Does that mean voters are seeing these partisan cues in these nonpartisan judicial races?
So I think, well, you can't really say anything about what individual voters are thinking when you're using counties, but to me it does say that there is a strong partisan component to the vote. If there wasn't, there wouldn't be any connection between these two measures of people's preferences. So it seems like partisanship is structuring how people are voting in these races, at least in the aggregate.
Talking to Aaron Weinschenk, political scientist at UW Green Bay, about Wisconsin Supreme Court elections and how partisan politics often makes its way into these officially nonpartisan races. Aaron, I want to take a step back because not every state does this like Wisconsin does. We have these nonpartisan elected judges. Some places there's elections, but they actually run on a party label. Some places there's no elections. Why do we have it the way we have it in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so a lot of the way that we do things is rooted in specific points in history or specific reforms that were brought up. And so the idea that we should use nonpartisan elections in state and local races actually dates back to the Progressive Era, which is a period of political reform and social reform in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And one of the ideas was we should use nonpartisan races to try to remove national politics or partisan affairs from these races at state and local levels of government.
Has that worked at all?
Well, at least in the past 10 years in Wisconsin, it doesn't seem to have worked. There's clearly a partisan component. Although in one of the races that I looked at, which was the 2003 race, there actually wasn't much of a connection between the presidential vote and the Supreme Court vote in that year. So to me, that suggests that it isn't always the case that partisanship is playing a role. But at least in the last 10 years or so in Wisconsin, it has been.
Now, in a partisan political race, a voter, and I know it's hard to talk about individuals here, but voters can look at a candidate and say, oh, they're from the party I prefer, I'll vote for them. Or they have a political platform that I like, I'll vote for them. How
Yep.
do voters evaluate judges? Do we know what a good judge is?
Yeah, I think that's the argument for some other sort of selection mechanism, like a commission recommending to the governor or some other political institution making the appointment, is, you know, maybe they don't really know what it takes to be a good judge. Maybe they don't know anything about the rulings that these people have made. And so do you want individual voters making these kinds of choices?
And not, as we said, not all states do have elections. What other kind of systems are out there for appointing judges?
That's right. You could have a something like a council that advises a governor or the legislature. You could have, say, the governor just directly appoint judicial candidates, although I think that clearly brings partisanship into it since governors have partisan attachments. You know, you could have a commission where, you know, they make the appointments. So there are other arrangements that I think we could consider. We sort of get locked into this idea of, like, this is what we've always had, so we have to have it forever. But we could change it if we didn't like what partisan elections were doing.
Can you talk a little bit about turnout in these judicial elections? They're in the spring. They're pretty far from the big ticket items like races for governor, Senate, and president. Do we turn out to vote for judges?
Yeah, it's not particularly good. We're pretty low on these races that are, you know, off cycle from a gubernatorial election or a presidential election. And then the fact that people don't have a lot of information about them, I think, hurts them. You know, they don't get all kinds of attention in the media. If you're really paying attention, you'll probably know and be aware. But, you know, they're not like a presidential race or a gubernatorial race where every day you're seeing ads or reading news stories about them. So they're hard to learn about.
And you mentioned earlier one of the reasons for these nonpartisan judicial races wasn't just to keep the parties out, but you said the word to keep national politics out. And in Wisconsin, have we seen national political figures weigh in on our Supreme Court elections?
Yeah, we have seen people endorse judicial candidates again in these nonpartisan races. So in 2011, I found a story where Sarah Palin endorsed the conservative candidate. Of course, the candidates in this race are actually mentioning political figures, not that that's an endorsement, but they are referencing people like the president, so that gives people pretty clear cues about what that person believes, or at least what side of the aisle they're on.
And what kind of research do you want to do next to follow up on this issue?
Yeah, I'd like to take a look at other states. You know, there are a good number of states that have nonpartisan elections, so I'd like to see, you know, if the same thing is happening there, that that these are basically partisan contests that are being called nonpartisan.
And you mentioned that just because we, you know, established this kind of election a century ago or whatever doesn't mean we have to do it forever. Do states around the country tend to change how they elect judges once they're locked in a particular way?
It's pretty rare. We get sort of stuck on a path, and it's usually hard to convince people to change. But there are states that have changed. Some have actually decided to move from nonpartisan to partisan elections. Some have gone in the other direction where they've had partisan, not liked it, and moved to some other mechanism. So it's pretty rare, but it does happen.
Is there, as we wrap up, is there a lot of academic research on how nonpartisan elections work?
There's not a lot, but there is a small group of people, I would say, who do work in this area, and a lot of them are trying to figure out if they actually do what they are intended to do. Do they really keep politics out? Do they increase turnout or decrease turnout? So there is some work being done on this.
We'll leave it there for now. Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Aaron Weinschenk. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joined us to talk about partisanship in our officially nonpartisan judicial races in Wisconsin, especially looking at the state Supreme Court. We're in the midst of an election campaign there now. He recently wrote a piece about the growing influence of politics in court races over at WisContext. You can read his piece at wiscontext.org. It's Oscar time with the Academy Awards coming up on Sunday. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get Oscar predictions from one of our favorite film critics. And all week, we're featuring some of the Oscar-nominated music. We want to hear from you. Tell us about your all-time favorite movie, song, or soundtrack. We've got at least a call or two we'll be sharing later this week. You can call and leave a message at our recording line, 833-424-3327. Again, that's 833-424-3327, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. A nomination in this year's Best Original Song category comes from the film Coco, which is also nominated for Best Animated Feature. The song we're going to hear is sung by the actor Benjamin Bratt, who until this film had never sung professionally. In fact, he says his kids can't stand it when he sings around the house or in the car. same as my family. Here's the song, Remember Me.
Remember me. Though I have to say goodbye, remember me. Don't let it make you cry. For even if I'm far away, I hold you in my heart. I sing a secret song to you each night we are apart. Remember me. Though I have to travel far, remember me. Each time you hear a sad guitar, know that I'm with you the only way that I can be. Until you ring my arms again, remember me.